From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a plague of mosquitoes in Michigan approaching biblical proportions.
From this exorbitant amount of rain in many areas, we're hatching out eggs from, in some cases, many years. Because it's been a while in some areas that they've received a rain that's actually flooded these low areas.
Also, Olympic BMX freestyle rider Hannah Roberts on the road to Tokyo.
This is who I was meant to be, and this I'm going to put everything I have into the sport. And, you know, from 10 years old, I knew that that's how it was going to be.
Plus, why rescue teams in Michigan's public parklands are busy. Turns out recreating takes practice. And what happened at one of Michigan's busiest library systems during COVID lockdown?
Well, the use of digital formats, of course, went up. And we expanded our digital collection, consequently.
Those stories just ahead. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, we're going to meet one of Team USA's gold medal hopefuls, a rock star BMX rider from Buchanan, Michigan, Hannah Roberts. That's coming up later in the hour, but first, if you live in Southeast Michigan, maybe parts north too, and if you've been outside for more than 30 seconds this week, you've no doubt noticed 2021 is quite the year for mosquitoes. With us today is Bill Stanusik. He directs the Saginaw County Mosquito Abatement Commission. Needless to say, he's a busy man this summer, but is giving us a few minutes of his time to talk bug shop. Bill, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Appreciate it.
Now, it's not just me, right? There are more mosquitoes than usual in circulation.
Oh, it's certainly not just you, and the phone calls prove that. And as I've looked outwardly from my concern here in Saginaw County to other communities a lot south of us and west of us, I think a lot of us are going through the same thing. Lots of mosquitoes.
How do you track the numbers?
You know, it's interesting now. It's the phone calls, I could say, but truly with integrated mosquito management program, and I know that's a mouthful, and there's fun acronyms, IMM, but this integration of, so we're trying to manage this mosquito population. So yes, we monitor with different types of mosquito traps. It's pretty basic, using different baits from CO2, like what we exhale, that's carbon dioxide. Using that as bait, we can go out and place these in the environment and track the mosquito population throughout the season. And they are certainly, in some cases, our traps are being overflowed with a variety of mosquitoes.
Well, what do we mean when we say overflowing? Like, what would you expect to see on a typical summer night for mosquitoes? And how does that compare with what you're seeing this year?
Yeah, so I think everyone can agree during the summer, we're probably out, and depending on if you're in the woods or maybe in a low area, at sunset, you may have to put a little repellent on or a couple slaps, but it's tolerable. So in a trap, that may be, let's say, 100 or so in a night was collected. Now, when you're trying to walk to your car just to go to work and it feels like you're eating them as you're walking there, you're likely looking at 1,000. And in some cases, I can put some traps out and get 10,000 mosquitoes in one, you know, putting it out at sunset and collecting it after the sunrise.
10,000 mosquitoes.
Yes.
Oh, that's incredible.
And unfortunately, collecting those 10,000 mosquitoes doesn't seem to make a difference for that an individual in that woodlot. So it speaks to the true number of mosquitoes that are out there in
right.
a given time.
Bill, why is this happening? I know that a lot of areas are experiencing wet weather, but what is going on?
Yeah, and I can get much into the details on water tables and such, but the simple answer, April, is rainfall. And I know a lot of us and those that are involved in agriculture and farmers, boy, we started out with such a dry spring, wondering when the rains would come. And then June, the end of June, here comes the rain. And I know locally in Saginaw County, up here around the Saginaw Bay area, some areas got over 6 inches of rain in nearly one weekend. So I know that rain was also received down in Southeast Michigan and portions of the west side of the state and central part of the state also. So rainfall equals standing water equals mosquitoes. And the more rain, the more standing water there is, so the more mosquitoes. And the mosquitoes come from the standing water because that's where they lay their eggs, in those low depressions that flood with substantial rainfall. And we're happy, my guess is, from this exorbitant amount of rain in many areas, we're hatching out eggs from, in some cases, many years. because it's been a while in some areas that they've received the rain that's actually flooded these low areas.
So that's a thing? Mosquito eggs laid in prior years can hatch now?
You got it. Yes. Like mosquitoes have been at this a lot longer than we've tried to control them, although I'm sure we've been slapping since mankind arrived. But certainly they are capable. And again, there's many different species of mosquitoes that have different egg-laying behavior. But for the sake of what we're talking about now, these are the mosquitoes, the nuisance mosquitoes that are biting everybody. And there's a handful of species within that, but they all share the characteristic that after they blood feed, and it's only the females that bite, and they blood feed so they can create their eggs, you know, through mating and such. But so the blood's necessary for egg production. So after they blood feed, they look for a place to lay their eggs. And these nuisance mosquitoes look for low depressions in our natural habitats and artificial in the case of buckets, or even artificial in the case of roadside ditches. But think of the swamps, the floodplains that are around our low areas, that are around our great state, that hold water, and the more water, the more mosquitoes.
Yeah. This crazy, crazy proliferation, what does this mean in Saginaw County, I guess in terms of public health?
Yeah, so there's two ways to think of nuisance mosquitoes. And when we talk public health mosquito control, we tend to think of the mosquito-borne virus that's out in the environment and the state. And people are very familiar with West Nile virus in the state of Michigan and in North America, for that matter. So that's kind of the textbook correlation with public health and mosquitoes and mosquito control. But when you have a nuisance of this amount, I think we can all agree that the stress that this puts on us as individuals, whether we're slapping or looking at our children getting bitten, I argue it does affect public health to some in some circumstance. So we are certainly out there trying to do our best to expedite getting relief to communities.
We haven't heard a ton so far this year about West Nile virus or Eastern equine encephalitis or Zika. The summer is young, I suppose, but does the fact that that conversation hasn't cropped up, does that mean we're not yet having problems with those diseases?
Yeah, we have certainly not, and we do quite a bit of sampling of mosquitoes. The different, I'm going to use the term vector, and when we say vector, that applies to a species, in this case, mosquitoes, that's capable of transmitting a disease. And to date, in our quite robust sampling, we have not found any West Nile virus. And I believe the state has yet to find West Nile virus in mosquitoes. And that's looking at different public health efforts, whether it's a standard public health department or another mosquito control district submitting samples, they have not found any positives. So that's a good thing. That's a good thing, as we're not finding that there's enough virus out there to detect yet. Being amplified, when it arrives, it normally amplifies over time. With West Nile virus, it amplifies in birds and mosquitoes. And if it goes unchecked, and of course, weather dictates a lot of this too, you can have, you know, a public health concern with these arboviruses or mosquito-borne viruses.
Yeah. Where is your agency at right now in terms of mitigation efforts?
Yes. So what we're doing now is with integrated mosquito management is there's different strategies to impact mosquito populations, whether we talk nuisance or disease carrying mosquitoes. Right now it's nuisance. So we did a lot of effort treating larval habitat, standing water early on. But when you have this much rain, there's a lot of habitat. Unfortunately, we can't get to it all. So we have these adults flying around. So now we are making every effort to go around and treat these adult populations with a spatial spray that goes out and impacts flying mosquitoes and just controls those adult mosquitoes flying. And we're not using a product that sticks around for an extended period of time. Our goal is to, as a community program, to get into our communities throughout the county as quick as we can, control a large area that is a multiple township area, and then get back to them as soon as possible. But unfortunately, to get back to that community, we have to go through other communities to do control. So we are throwing extra shifts and efforts at controlling those adult mosquitoes.
Yeah. Bill, last night was the first night that I started to go outside to the grill to grill the food I was making for dinner and just thought, nope, too buggy. And that's the first time that has ever happened to me where I actually changed my dinner plan because of that. What do you usually recommend to folks who are trying to deal with this at home? I mean, is it just a fan outside the patio table, or what's the play?
Yeah, April, and the fan by the patio table is probably your best answer if you're stationary, you're trying to grill. And let's put it this way, you want a substantial fan, not the little fan. You want the big box fan,
yeah,
one that can push air. And I understand mosquitoes are at a point where it's almost like you're walking through them. They're not coming to you. You're walking through them. So yes, a fan, a repellent of your choice. I will say that DEET still is one of our best repellents out there. Use that. And again, mosquitoes will still bump into you. But the idea is they want to blood feed on you, and that causes that itch. And many bites causes many itches, and that's what's happening now. But also remember that it's these bites that can transmit disease too. Now, a lot of these nuisance mosquitoes don't transmit a lot of the diseases we're concerned with, but there's always that possibility. So repellent works great. And as I like to think too, and I know this isn't popular, or people don't want to, may not want to accept this, but think of these heavy mosquitoes as a rain event. So you have this picnic planned and, you know, the rain, you get a thunderstorm. Well, there goes the picnic. Unfortunately, sometimes plans may have to be changed. And we ask for a lot of patience too, during these large outbreaks also.
For sure. We've been talking today with Bill Stanuzik of the Saginaw County Mosquito Abatement Commission. Bill, we're looking forward to the drive-in premiere of Blood Feed in Saginaw drive-in theaters and other movie outlets around Southeast Michigan. Thank you very much for cluing us in and helping us stay away from the bugs.
Thank you, April. It was a pleasure. And again, everybody just have a little patience. In a couple of weeks, hopefully we're concerned about something else besides all these mosquitoes.
Up next, Hannah Roberts talks to us about chasing a gold medal in Tokyo for BMX freestyle and what action sports mean to the Olympics.
Having skateboarding and having surfing and BMX, like, it's another way for like younger kids to be like, yeah, you know, I want to be an Olympian because there's something that I'm actually interested in.
That's after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. After COVID-19 canceled the 2020 Tokyo Summer Olympic Games, we're now less than a month away from the July 23rd opening ceremony for a delayed Olympic process. Team USA includes incredible members, Simone Biles and Ryan Murphy. We at Stateside, however, are particularly excited for one of Team USA's gold hopefuls, Hannah Roberts, the pride of Buchanan. Hannah has been riding BMX since age 9. She is now a 3-time World Cup freestyle winner and 3-time world champion. We are so, so happy to welcome this amazing person to talk about her journey from the Great Lakes to the great big 5 rings. Hannah Roberts, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
There are some events in which Olympic competition really isn't that different from world championships, but for others, the stakes are really higher. How would you say this is for you?
Well, this is our first Olympics. This is the first time that our sport is,
for
is
freestyle. Yeah.
Sport. Yeah. So, right now nobody really knows exactly how this is going to affect, you know, our sport. We all are hoping and stuff that it's in a positive way. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of positives about, you know, the Olympics, but, for me right now, I'm just looking at it like another contest, and I'm just going to go and have fun with my friends and just try to do my best no matter what. So,
Hannah, I feel like some people would say that the Olympics needed BMX freestyle more than BMX freestyle needed the Olympics, so to speak. Do you have a take on that?
Yeah. Growing up, obviously, I watched the Olympics a lot. My original goal when I was really little was to be an Olympic soccer player. But a lot of today's, you know, youth doesn't necessarily like all aspects of sports that have been in it for a long time, like soccer and you know, basketball. You know, they like those sports, but I never really liked the team aspect. So I could see how, you know, straying away to action sports is a little bit more exciting for the younger group. So, yeah, I mean, having skateboarding and having surfing and BMX, like it's another way for like younger kids to be like, yeah, you know, I want to be an Olympian because there's something that I'm actually interested in.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's going to help the Olympics a lot. And, you know, I think it's going to help our sport grow, and get more rider, you know, get more people to see that we are a sport and that, you know, doing flips on bikes is cool.
If you can see it, you're more likely to be it.
Yeah.
Right. I wanted to ask a little bit about what you've been doing to get ready. I mean, back in February 2020, which was what, like 10 years ago now? You qualified for the Olympics. How did you manage to stay motivated through all this time to get your head in the right place for where you want to be in Tokyo?
Well, luckily, I had actually moved down to North Carolina just for training reasons and the summer of 2019, right after I graduated high school. And when it came to qualifying and everything, I was up with my family and I was just visiting for a week or so. And that's when it got announced. So it was really cool that I was able to spend it with them. But I knew from then, and I don't think it was announced that it was postponed yet, but I knew from then that I wanted to start working and getting, you know, everything set because, you know, that I thought that I only had a few months. But when it got postponed, it was mentally hard, but I'm grateful that in North Carolina I had a phenomenal group of athletes to work with. And, you know, I think there was 8 of us and we were all either trying to be at the Olympics, like trying to compete for our respected countries at the Olympics or Olympic bound. So it was good. We made, you know, a strict kind of quarantine within ourselves. Like we couldn't go into public at all. No grocery
right.
stores, no anything, which obviously we all respected and we wanted to keep each other and ourselves safe. So it was between going home and going to the skate park. And that's what we did every day for 3 months. And luckily I had, you know, an amazing group of riders and athletes and support down here to keep me motivated. But, you know, after quarantine, when you're doing the same thing with the same people every single day, all day for 3 months, it gets pretty exhausting. So I lean more towards my wife now to help me out of a little bit of a depression that I fell into just because I was training all the time. And yeah, it was just the support, and that's how I got through last year. It was a big struggle, and I don't think I would have made it through or made it out the same if I didn't have, you know, the athletes that I had, my family behind me, and of course my wife next to me through every step of it. So,
yeah, I heard she got married this year. Congratulations!
Thank you. Yeah, the first of the year.
I know the crowd situation is going to be very different in Tokyo than usual. Is Kelsey going to be allowed to go over and watch?
No, there's absolutely no foreign spectators, and I think that Japan just declared another state of emergency, so I don't even think that there's going to be Japanese fans there anymore.
Oh, geez. It's I imagine just not having the crowd there is probably a different psychological consideration for you, too.
Yeah, it's, you know, when there's a crowd there, they're usually the ones that get you, like, hyped up. And, you know, the cheering, it just gets your adrenaline pumping and stuff. And obviously, the other athletes and the other teams, we're all friends. And, you know, we all respect each other. We want nothing but the best for each other. So, obviously, they'll be cheering and they'll be, you know, there to support. But it's different when there's other eyes on you. And, yeah, it's more of a you have to motivate yourself kind of thing. So yeah, it's a little bit weird, but I guess it's the new normal for right now. And we're just going to have to do what we got to do and, you know, do our best.
Yeah. For those who've never partaken or who haven't watched the X Games or something, freestyle is a sport in which riders get 2 runs. They're about a minute long each. And they're showing skills and doing tricks, and you get scored for creativity, of course, but also for things like execution and height. What do you think sets freestyle apart from some of the other BMX events?
You know, BMX racing is an amazing event. Obviously, it's a strength and speed event. Like, you know, you have, it's basically 8 riders drop at the exact same time, and whoever gets there fastest, whoever has the best technique to get through the course is usually who wins. But for our sport, you know, it's 1 rider on the course for a full 60 seconds, and it's kind of just showing it's a way for you to show yourself on your bike. Like nobody's style is the exact same. You won't see riders that do the exact same things every single hit, just because, you know, it's a variety. It's a diversity, between, you know, what you like to do and what you want to do. So the creative level is a whole nother thing, because you could just go and, you know, ride the entire course, do whatever you want. And then, you know, that the person behind you isn't going to do exactly what you did. So, it's always super fun to watch, and it's super interesting to see like people's take on a course or people's take on a certain trick and stuff. So
if you're just joining us, we're talking today with Hannah Roberts. She rides BMX freestyle and will be representing Team USA at the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. She grew up in Buchanan, Michigan. So you have a cousin, Brett Benesiewicz, who's a pretty well-known BMX rider. And you know, there were any number of ways you could have entered the sport. How did you kind of find your place in freestyle and develop what is now like your defining, you know, the things that define you on the bike?
You know, I got into BMX just watching a TV on or a contest on TV, excuse me. And, yeah, I kind of fell in love with it. I had my dad, you know, give me a bike and, you know, we went to try it out. Brett built the skate park that I grew up riding. And, you know, he was gone a lot traveling, but when he was in town, if I needed help, you know, I'd ask. And if not, then I would just be there hours on end working on a random trick until I landed it. And, just never really gave up. I've seen him, you know, struggle on a trick for multiple hours and then finally land it. And it really taught me, like, you know, if I really want something, I can do it no matter what. I just have to actually put in the time. So watching him and other riders that just kept up and never really took no for an answer, that was kind of what helped me get to where I am.
Right. You mentioned the fact that you started out thinking you were going to go all in on soccer. How old were you when you decided to, you know, that maybe that wasn't it, that maybe it was riding?
I actually played soccer for a lot of my childhood. I was a goalie and I loved it. But when I broke my back when I was 10, it kind of took out all other sports besides BMX. Everything was just, you know, too painful. Either, you know, running or falling or when I played football, getting tackled, everything was just too much for my back. So unfortunately kind of crushed the soccer dream a little bit, but, you know, I loved BMX at that point. I was all in. When I got back on my bike, I knew that's where I wanted to be and that's where what I was drawn to the most. So, yeah. You know, it worked out good in the end, but, yeah, soccer ended when I was 10.
You know, it's not unusual to find people competing who've had big crack-ups in their past that they had to get past. But I can't think of any off the top of my head who have that kind of story where they literally had to switch gears and then became world-renowned because of it. I mean, did it seem to you at the time like it was the end of the world?
When I fell and I spent like 2 or 3 days or something in the hospital, I didn't know if I ever wanted to touch a bike again. It was, hard for, I knew exactly what I did wrong when I fell. But like just hearing the injuries, I was the youngest person at that, the hospital, that have had those injuries. So they had to send me to a children's hospital 3 hours away.
Jeez.
And, I had to talk to specialists and, you know, they were debating on whether to do surgery or not. Luckily, they didn't. So it was scary. It was my first big injury. I hadn't even, like, broken a hand or anything before that. That was, like, my first injury was a broken back and a broken neck. And I didn't actually know if I wanted to ride again. I didn't actually know if I wanted to, you know, play sports again. And it took me a little bit to gain my confidence back. And when I was in the hospital, there was pros at a detour event, and they called me, you know, all wished me well and told me that I'd be back to 100% in no time. And, you know, I was like, if they believe in me, then I need to believe in myself. And, you know, at 10 years old, it's hard to realize that, but I just started, you know, my recovery. I just watched a lot of BMX videos. And once I got back on my bike and I started feeling comfortable and kind of like secure that I that it was just like an off day, and it was just a, you know, not a one-time injury, because it could happen again, but it was just, you know, a mistake that I made, and I know that not to make it again. Like, once I figured that out, I was like, this is who I was meant to be, and this, I'm going to put everything I have into this sport. And, you know, from 10 years old, I knew that that's how it was going to be. So yeah, I just gave it my all, and I've had a lot of broken bones, and I've had a lot of, you know, torn ligaments and dislocated shoulders and all that stuff. But, you know, I just try to get back up, and I always remember, you know, why I put myself through this, and, you know, all the steps that I take, because I actually, you know, I love this sport, and it's part of me now. So,
yeah. When you think about your childhood, I mean, obviously Brett was a big influence in being able to ride at his park, but was there anything else in, you know, in Buchanan, Michigan that really made you see a place for yourself, you know, as a girl in this sport that wasn't even, you know, wasn't even an Olympic event at that point? And I kind of feel like at the age you were riding, it maybe, I don't know if the professional path was as clear.
No, I mean, there wasn't too many, when I started riding, there wasn't too many girls. There were actually, I don't think there was any girls that were riding full time. They were going to maybe one or two events a year. They were riding for maybe one or two companies, but wasn't making any kind of money to make it a full-time thing. I know a lot of them had, you know, other jobs or were going to school for a certain thing and then going into the work field after that. So, I didn't even know if it was possible to make it a full-time career. There was no companies necessarily looking for women's riders when I was young. And I just knew that I loved it. You know, in my head, I was like, well, if I ride good enough and if I can hold my own against the guys, then there's absolutely no way they can deny me, you know, a spot on the team for being a girl. I was like, if I could ride just like everybody else, then there's nothing holding me back. Luckily, you know, I had my dad who never lost faith in me, and even on my hard days, he pushed me. And, you know, my childhood wasn't like anything else. I had to miss a lot of school for either training or competitions or stuff like that. I didn't really get to hang out with my friends too much, but overall, like, I wouldn't have it any other way. And luckily, you know, throughout my entire journey, my town Buchanan has just been so supportive, and you know, whatever I needed, especially when I was in school, like extra tutoring, or if I was going to be gone for a while, I'd get all my stuff early. My teachers never gave me any hassle, and you know, the principals never gave me any hassle. They all understood, and they all seen my dream. So you know, without them, I don't think I'd be in the position I am today.
I haven't been there yet. I moved here a little before the pandemic, but Buchanan sounds like an amazing place in that the town could support you on this journey, but also support a young gay woman making her way in the sports world.
Yeah, they, you know, one of the main things that we say in the town is small town, big hearts, and it is very much like that. I mean, it's a very small town. You know, everybody knows everybody basically, but they have some of the biggest hearts, and it's such an amazing community to be a part of. I'm so grateful that I got to grow up there and spend my childhood there, and you know, really realize what true friendship and true compassion for others is. Just, you know, getting the feeling of people supporting me through my dreams, even if it's people I've never met before. Like on my Facebook page, there's a lot of people who are from Buchanan, and I know that I haven't met them yet, but they, you know, fully back me 100%, and they leave a lot of kind words and stuff, and it really does mean a lot, and it's really incredible to see, especially now when I live in a big town in North Carolina, and it's like complete opposite, but yeah.
Well, Hannah Roberts, we wish you, it's going to be a weird trip, but we wish you the best experience that you can possibly have this month. It's been really amazing talking to you.
Thank you.
Hannah Roberts will ride BMX freestyle for Team USA as the Olympics begin in Tokyo starting July 23rd. If you are loving all this pre-funk talk about the Olympics, have you checked out the Stateside podcast lately? We had this great conversation with Dr. Stefan Szymański on his upcoming virtual exhibition about Detroit's historic relationship with the Olympic Games. You can listen to that and lots of other podcast episodes on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, at michiganradio.org, or wherever you listen. Just a reminder, too, Stefan's got a fascinating story to tell that includes a lot more than we got to in the pod. He's going to be part of a free Michigan Radio virtual event, Thursday, July 20th, called Detroit's Olympic Dreams, with our good friend Doug Tribou hosting. He is the anchor for Morning Edition on Michigan Radio. You can reserve your spot right now. Doesn't cost a thing. Just check the website for all the info, michiganradio.org. We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. But we'd love to actually hear from you, too. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state and maybe some stories that we might be missing. You can also connect with other listeners and Stateside staff about the show. There are a couple of places to find us. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Also, you can find us on Facebook on the Michigan Radio page, or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. People are recreating in Michigan's public wildlands in huge numbers. The pandemic brought a record number of crowds to the state parks last year. That brought an increase in search and rescue missions for folks in the purview of the Department of Natural Resources. Is it just the increase in visitors, or could we all use a refresher course in hiking, boating, and camping safely? Ron Olson joins us now, Chief of the Parks and Recreation Division of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. Hey, Ron, welcome back to Stateside.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, let's just figure out where we are at the moment. Are there a lot of folks visiting the state parks this year?
Yes, we're up. Last year, decided an increase. We went almost to 35 million visitors, up from about 28 million. So it was up near almost 30%. And this year so far, we have very strong visitation, particularly during the week, because for some reason people are more fluid. Maybe it's because of the teleworking and some other things. But so we've had a very robust season so far.
No question. Prior to the pandemic, search and rescue events weren't uncommon, certainly. But I read that at Porcupine Mountains Wilderness State Park, it was ranging about 12 to 18 missions in a given year, but that last year, rangers responded to calls from 52 people. What do you think is going on?
Well, we've talked to our staff up there, and yeah, it is more than coincidence. It's clearly what they've reported was a lot of the folks that they assisted in that got lost, because they were not prepared with navigation. Sometimes you depend on cell phones, and yet in the backcountry up there in the wilderness, and cell coverage is pretty sparse. And people didn't have other devices like some kind of a compass device or something like that they could utilize. Also, if people were not prepared either with their clothing or their footwear and things like that, and kind of got out there and things became more difficult than they thought and got in harm's way. I think we had somebody that hurt their ankle and things like that, and they had to be rescued. But most of the people lost their way, and we had to send out people to help guide them back and things like that. So we have had sometimes medical emergencies, people that have had heart problems or other things like that from time to time. But there has been people that have fallen or tripped on a rock or something like that. But generally speaking, what our observation was is that some of the increase was because people weren't as prepared as some seasoned hikers and people like that might have been there. And people read about the Porcupine Mountains is an example. It's a cool place to visit. And a lot of people we found, even in other parks, particularly up there, there was apparently, from observation from our staff, a lot of new visitors that had never been there before and were just checking it out. And Yeah, so that's what we believe, is just the fact that people weren't prepared and probably got overwhelmed and probably took off thinking they had the ability to deal with it and probably literally got over their head with their ability and the capacity to do things and got themselves in a jam. So now what we're doing is we're encouraging people to be prepared.
Ron, would you say that every search and rescue situation is necessarily a life-threatening one?
No, not really. We've, like I said, we've had accidents and things like that, but people get confused and, you know, they get worried, and there are folks that they know they're out there and they haven't come back yet or something like that. But, you know, particularly sometimes the weather can change a lot up in the UP, and it can get, you know, if you have to spend the night and you're not prepared, it can get cold or some other circumstances. And yeah, that can create some problems. But most of it's just, you know, like I said, are people that simply lost their way. And the good news is we were able to help them out before, if things strung out, it might have gotten more precarious with the, like I said, maybe having to spend the night out in the wilderness or mm-hmm. something like that,
yeah.
which could make it difficult for somebody.
Ron, what kind of resources are needed in these situations? Does this put a serious burden on the budget for search and rescue?
Well, we have trained staff that are trained in this. We have equipment that's designed to go into the backcountry, like many of the parks like this around the country, where you have if somebody can't walk, there's a gurney that has an all-terrain wheel on it and things like that. And so the staff are trained on how to go about these things. And because a lot of the backcountry areas, you can't get a ORV or a vehicle back into some of these areas. Some of it you can, but a lot of the areas have to be hiked in. So you have to have people that are skilled at being able to do that. And then they have to be prepared to render first aid and things like that. So they're, luckily we have well-trained staff that are prepared for that.
Ron Olson is chief of the Parks and Recreations Division of Michigan's Department of Natural Resources. Ron, I imagine that there will continue to be substantial crowds visiting the parks. So we wish you and the staff a safe rest of the summer.
Yeah, we appreciate it. And we just ask people to go out and enjoy yourself and, you know, do a little research before you come. And that helps with making your experience a good one.
This week is a huge one for the Ann Arbor District Library. After nearly a year in full lockdown, branches are reopening for summer readers who are longing to see books, to put their hands on books, to talk to librarians. What a time when so many Michiganders were in need of a good read and the comfort and solace that books can bring us. And community libraries, with their community, to be limited to the bloodless, if hygienic, contact-free exchange? That's all over starting this week. Josie Parker is director of the Ann Arbor District Library, and she joins us now. Josie, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us about the factors that led you to close the branches to the public last March.
Well, I think our decision was one that was made by many institutions and organizations within that very short period of time in March a year ago. I think we knew that the numbers were going to climb. We understood the science. And so we made the decision to close completely for several months. And then we reopened back up in order to provide our vestibule service and our locker service. The whole time, though, in March through June, before we reopened for vestibule service, we were operating by phone and online with our programming. So the library pivoted very quickly to a virtual program experience and real-time reference and assistance by phone. We never really were totally closed.
I think this is a model that a lot of libraries around Michigan have had to deal with, sort of a year of hybrid, you know, just doing what you can based on infection rates in the area. What would you say has been most challenging about the past year?
Oh, I think for me personally, and I think for a number of the people who manage and supervise here, it was keeping a connection to the staff, holding us together as a unit and a culture so that the initiatives and ideas could still bubble up in ways where we could continue to serve the public and give people the opportunity to do that. I think that was the challenge from an administrative point of view. And I think also we were very, very interested in making sure that the public library still was available to our community in whatever way we could bring it. That was always in front of us. That was the goal. So that staying connected to people was the big challenge.
What can you tell us about library usage numbers during the time when you were just providing that vestibule service, getting books ready for people and giving them to them contact-free when they turned up?
Surprisingly, our numbers were relatively high for vestibule service compared to what we did the year prior, where people were able to come in and come out. We were at around 65-70% of normal operating through the vestibules, which is amazing, really. So all that time, we had people working in the building, masks and distance, and in what we called pods. We kept people isolated to work groups in specific locations throughout the entire time so that if there was a positive COVID test within the staff, it would only affect a certain number of people and a few people. Fortunately, while there were people on staff who tested positive for COVID, there was never spread on staff. So we were very relieved about that. But our numbers were high.
What happened with use of digital formats during this time?
Well, the use of digital formats, of course, went up. And we expanded our digital collection, consequently. I mean, the New York Times became available at no charge digitally to our patrons during this period of time, as did the Wall Street Journal, which is limited. It will end at the end of the year, that offer. Some of the publishers we deal with who publish digitally offered us more for circulation at little or no charge during COVID. So it was a year where behind the scenes within the world of books and publishing and digital information, the people who produce it were working really hard to help us circulate it, to provide it, to keep it there for people. So there was a lot of generosity and a lot of sharing going on.
Do you think that the experiences people have had in the past year will mean any kind of long-term changes in how they use their library?
I can't imagine that it won't, and I can't imagine how it wouldn't. I think that we all have to come through this period of time with differences that we have to adjust to. And every way that we think about how we operate, how much we're around people or not, how we use the institution of the public library, what it means to a person now probably is different from what it might have meant a year and a half ago. I think we'll find that out over the next year. We can't know now. So we're opening today and we're trying to bring the services that we had before COVID back to people. And our eyes are open and our ears are open to listen and see how our community comes back to the library, what their experience is here now, how that's changed, and what they want for us going forward. We've always done that, but under these circumstances, I think we're all a little bit more intensely sensitive to this situation.
Right. As people do come back to their libraries, will they find them very much changed in any way?
Not so much in the ways of shelving, material on shelves, places to sit, computing areas, places to sit with your computer. In the AADL, person may be in our library all day long. We never look at that in terms of how long have you been here? What are you doing here? So they can be here. I think what they will find is we took the opportunity to do things that we were able to do when contractors were able to work. So there was a lot of recarpeting done. We redid completely the youth department restrooms downtown. We've added some spaces in the branches, some meeting area spaces in the branches, so that we'll be able to have more rooms for people to have small group meetings, or in one case, a larger group meeting. A lot of our buildings have, on the insides, were repainted. So I think if people feel the difference, it'll be subtle in the main and welcome. We also added a large screen in our lobbytorium downtown to help with our major events, which was a gift from the Ladies Library Association. So there are some changes, but it's hopefully nothing that will jar anyone, or where they'll feel like their library changed in a way that they can't abide.
What kinds of things needed to happen to get you ready for the reopening?
Oh my, it's been quite a week. So because we had people in the buildings all throughout this period of time, making sure that material was available to folks who requested it, and also checking in the tens of thousands of items that were being brought back from folks who had already had material out, we had to space the workstations out all over the system in order to distance people. And that included out into public areas and every building. All of that had to be taken down and the spaces put back into the normal work areas. The vestibules were essentially rooms. By last week, those had been built out in such a way that they were rooms with structured walls and doors, and those areas had to be deconstructed and put back. The work that was being done inside the building was finishing up. So we've had to take down a lot of things, put all the furniture back, put the computers back where we had moved things. So it was a lot of internal staff work that had to happen to make it ready. And so it's open. People are ready. People are really, really excited.
Oh my gosh. What kind of feedback were you getting from people both today and in the run-up to reopening?
Into the run-up to reopening, for the most part, people were excited, very supportive. I would say that 99% of the folks who've given feedback to the library throughout the pandemic have been very supportive and very positive about the library's approach and service and disservice decisions. Some of the things we've done, we'll continue to do. We added pickup lockers everywhere except downtown, so that will be a part of our service going forward. Shelf service, where you can let us know via email that you would like a bag of books on a certain subject. We'll put it together for you, and you pick it up, check it out, and it's sort of a surprise. We're going to continue doing that. You know, the folks who are negative are people who question COVID's existence, that sort of thing. You know, we're very respectful of criticism, and we handle that in a respectful manner. But for the most part, people are just thrilled to be able to come back in their public library in Ann Arbor.
Looking back, do you think that making the closure for the period that you did was the right decision?
Yes, I do. I have no regrets about closing the library in March a year ago and keeping it closed. None. We did not have COVID spread within our staff, and we had people working here all through this. We did not have any known instances of spread from our staff to our users because of the way we manage our vestibules as contactless. I think that the goal was to mitigate infection. That was the point. And to be a part of helping that happen. And so now in Washtenaw County, the numbers are really low, and the library did its part. We did what we should do to help make that happen. So no, I don't have any regrets about that at all.
Josie Parker is director of the Ann Arbor District Library. Josie, it's great talking to you. Congratulations on reopening.
Thank you very much. Enjoy your day, and I hope to see you in the library.
And that's our show for today. Stateside's produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Ronia Cabansag, Chantel Phillips, Lucas Pollock, and Mary Claire Zowell. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Great to have you with us. See you tomorrow.